When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. If I sound a bit croaky, that's because I'm just recovering from a cold. This week, I'm talking to Kate Sawyer about her post-apocalyptic debut, The Stranding, which has just been published in paperback. Kate was born in Suffolk and grew up in the countryside as the eldest of four siblings. She's an actor and a founding member of the Faction Theatre Company and has established the Curious Room Theatre Company herself. In this episode, we discuss writing a sensory experience to make the surreal plausible, varying your writing routine, and being your own biggest champion. But first, here's Kate with an excerpt from The Stranding.
Among the masses of driftwood, the creature lies sprawled on black-flecked sand. From far away, it had looked like a giant slug, bloated on the shore, but now, nearing it, Ruth can see it is a mammal. A warm-blooded, air-breathing mammal with a belly button, just like her. The size is overwhelming. Too much for her exhausted brain to take in, her eyes too. For a second, she wonders if she might be hallucinating, but no. There is the smell. She can almost taste it. She has come so far to be here, to see this animal. It is a moment she has envisaged ever since she was a little girl. But it was never like this. Never in these circumstances. It is so big that as she gets closer, her muscles aching, her breathing ragged, she realises her eyes are tracking back and forth. Past the elegant fin splayed among the trailing seaweed, from muzzle to flukes and back again, just to take in the whole animal. As big as two double-decker buses. How many times has she read that?
Hi, Kate. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you here with me today to talk about your debut novel, The Stranding.
Thanks so much for having me, Chloe. It's great to be here. I'm going to make lots of confessions on Confessions of a Novelist.
Good, that's what we want. So can you start us off by explaining what the plot of your novel, The Stranding, is about?
Yes. So the headline is that it's about a woman who survives the end of the world by hiding inside a whale. It's slightly more complex than that, in that it's two timelines that interweave following the journey of Ruth, both before the apocalypse in London and after the apocalypse in New Zealand. And the whale is something that she uses to avoid this blast. And she survives with another person, Nick, who is from New Zealand. So they are the man and woman who survived the end of the world.
Yeah, and that image of someone surviving in the belly of a whale is just incredible, and it's so unique. So how on earth did that idea come to you?
Well, I suppose it came because I wasn't looking for it, like so many of these things. I was doing a writing challenge alongside my job in events, at a point where I wasn't really acting that much. I was doing a bit of writing, like film and scripts, and I wanted to develop that, but I wasn't sure which way it was going to go. So I was doing some challenges to keep my writing going alongside earning money. And one of the challenges of this 28 plays later, to write a play a day for 28 days in February, the challenge, the prompt was Blue Whale. And I did a bit of Googling and saw where you could possibly see a blue whale. And I just had this image of a family living inside the bones of a beached whale. And I just wrote this family basically bickering outside their tent, talking about how it happened, how they came to be living inside that whale. And that scene is still in the book, but it expanded in both directions from that.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's sort of like the origin story of the idea. I guess that's what I ended up writing. And in general, I think that's something that helps me, is to find an idea and then explore how that came about. And the story therefore isn't linear necessarily, but it spreads out its tentacles from either side.
So did you find that you just kept returning to that idea in your mind when you were doing other things? Did it kind of stay with you?
Yeah, I sort of thought it was a good idea, and I sort of liked the characters. It was a short play, as in like a 5-minute play, you know. And I got some friends to read it through. We read through a few of our short plays, and I just felt like there was something there with it. And then essentially I sat down to write the first 10,000 words because I decided I wanted to apply to a master's, a creative writing master's. I think I was a bit lost, really. I didn't really want to act anymore. I was making short films, like directing, trying out directing and writing, and trying to work out if I could try and forge a career in TV or film, like on the other side of the camera. But I was finding it really difficult to break into, and there was like a real creative pleasure in writing. So I decided I wanted to do an MA to sort of work out where I was going to try and make a career. And yeah, so I applied to UEA, but because I didn't do a degree, because I did a drama diploma, I had to write 10,000 words or whatever, because without the degree to do it. And so I wrote 10,000 words of The Stranding and 10,000 words of something else, and I showed them both to my mum, and my mum was like, well, I like them both, but this is the more interesting idea. And when I had the interview at UEA, they were like, keep writing this. And so I did.
Great. I want to touch briefly again on this idea of this whale, mm-hmm. because it's obviously it's a surreal image, and it works so well in the novel because you completely buy into it. Obviously there's an element of suspension of disbelief, but there's never a point where as a reader I was thinking, well, this just couldn't happen, because you've made it so convincing in the novel. And your characters even question it at one point and say, you know, did we imagine it? Did it definitely happen? So how did you make it so convincing? How did you kind of go about constructing this very odd situation and yet make it feel so plausible?
I think part of it is to do with perspective. So talking about this like sensory experience for the two characters whose perspectives it's from, and just thinking about what feels real to any of us. I mean, we're all living in a simulation anyway, Chloe. So you know, but I mean, I suppose I'm going from that idea, like, what is real really? And for me, it's what we experience by our senses, at least that's what we think it is. And so if I get inside the sort of experience of the characters and explain it that way, in a sort of quite visceral, you know, almost gross way at times, then does that maybe that's part of why it seems real, because you can imagine the how disgusting it would be to be inside a whale's mouth, if I explain it like that. And I think it's the juxtaposition of that leap of imagination alongside the really ordinary stuff that we recognize about London, which essentially is the same thing coming from Ruth's perspective in a sort of quite sensual way. It's still just her perspective of the world.
Yeah, that juxtaposition between the everyday. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of a scene where Ruth's listening to a conversation in a cafe where someone's deciding what to order, and they want to order something gluten-free, and then it ends up having fruit in it and they can't have it. And just those kind of everyday snippets of life against this this end of the world scenario does, like you say, help to make it more real, because you're observing things that are very familiar to us and then taking us somewhere that's really unfamiliar, and yet we can plant ourselves in this end of the world scenario. Have you always been interested in that kind of like post-apocalyptic fiction? Was that something that you've been drawn to before, or was this totally kind of out of the blue for you to write this?
Well, I'm quite scared of post-apocalyptic fiction, and certainly my awareness of sort of like the canon of that genre was minimal. However, I am a bit of a catastrophizer, or rather, I like personally to think of the worst case scenarios so that I can draw myself back. Like, it's like an anxiety technique to sort of like, how bad could it be? Because then I feel quite grateful for the situation as it is. And so, that is something that definitely writers that write about apocalypse are playing with anyway, using it as a way to talk about that. So I suppose that is sort of an innate thing in me, but I hadn't really read a huge amount of it. I'd avoided The Road because I'd heard that it's about an apocalypse and it scared me, the idea of it. I mentioned to a friend when I was like about halfway through writing the manuscript, the first draft, I mentioned to a friend about it, and he said, oh, so it's like on the beach. And I was like, what? And he was like, Neville Shute's novel. And I wasn't aware of it. So what I did is, during the writing of it, I made a list of books that I hadn't read, and I read them before it went on submission, some of them, and then further into the editing process. So I didn't use them as like reference points, but it was really interesting to read how my version of an apocalypse sort of fit into other books. I read Oryx and Crake and On the Road and The Beach, but when I was younger, I loved Children of the Dust, like to a point of obsession, read it, I can't remember how many times, because it scared me so much, and reading it somehow felt, it made me feel better for some reason. Because of the survival element of it. And I suppose that has fed into The Stranding, because it isn't really about the destruction of the apocalypse. It's about navigating the worst case scenario. And I also love Zeb for Zachariah, which I hadn't watched the film. I only watched the film of really recently, but I did read it when I was a child. Again, the film, the idea of it scares me, but watching it, I really enjoyed it, because it's that same thing. It's sort of like, how does human nature respond to this? How would it respond to a new environment? Is what I'm interested in. Not only, but that's one of the things that I'm interested in a particular lens.
Let's talk a little bit about your kind of, I'm going to call it like the everyday strand, where we see Ruth in London living out her life. Obviously, the story idea started as this family living in the bones of a whale. But When did you get to the point where you decided to have this other strand of story going alongside it, which is kind of a more familiar story to us? When did that come into being? Was that later on down the line, or did you always have an idea in your mind that you wanted these two stories to run alongside each other?
I suppose I didn't know that I wanted them to run alongside each other, but the process was, I had that idea of them on the beach talking about the way life used to be. And so even in that initial idea, there was this like looking back to the world as it was, which is the world that we are in now. And so the first scene I wrote other than that was a scene that is the first scene in London in Ruth's life, because I just was like, okay, so how did she get from point A? How did she get from being a woman that was living an ordinary life in London to hiding inside a whale? I mean, that's essentially what the story is. And so I started, well, what would be a very ordinary thing to do? To go on a date in London at Gordon's Wine Bar is essentially the where I started. And then I started exploring things. So yeah, the story built from that. But as I wrote that, I started to work out what her life was with Nick as well, what the life post-apocalyptically was. And so it did sort of naturally happen in tandem. It's that bit of a joy of the writing your first novel, because it's all just play and it's all, there's no deadlines. There's no thinking that anyone's ever going to see it. So you're just playing, really.
Can you talk to us then a little bit about your characterization of Ruth? Because what I really liked about her is that, so we're seeing her, obviously, in at the end of the world stage, it's a very extreme situation. But in her kind of everyday life, she's quite a flawed character. She makes some sort of bad decisions, mistakes. She's almost more herself, more settled in when the world's ended. So can you talk a little bit about how she came to life when you were writing?
I suppose that I wanted her to make quite a lot of bad decisions, but I didn't want to, not just bad decisions. She doesn't make just bad decisions. So it was a bit of it. I wanted to write a every woman. So I sort of wanted to explore these like rites of passage is the wrong word, but like maybe things that happen in many women's lives, I suppose, from different perspectives. And I didn't want to make elements of her personality innate, because I'm not so sure that we have innate qualities. I think that our environment dictates a lot of it, our experiences and the choices that we have to make, often in a split second, that builds our personality. So I suppose I wanted to talk about the redemption, the potential for redemption as well. It all depends on your point of view, because the things she does that are bad in the London strand, are they really that bad in perspective of what else is going on in the world? Like, is it so bad to have an affair with someone that's married? I'm not entirely sure. Like, obviously for the people that affects, it's awful. But so yeah, I was interested in the sort of morality of characters. And apart from that, I just also wanted to write someone that isn't good, mm-hmm. a nice character. I think there are a lot out there. I think there's a lot of interesting and complex characters in books, but I suppose that there were some things that I wanted to explore that I hadn't seen that much of. One of them being like her, even like the stuff about her body that is touched on in books, and Marion Keyes does a great job, obviously, of talking about different bodies and what it's like to live in different bodies. But when I read the audiobook, I was like, wow, quite a lot of stuff about going to the toilet in this, Kate. which I hadn't realised when I was writing it. But I suppose part of me wanted to talk about that stuff because it just doesn't seem to be that. And also, when toilets are removed from our world, it becomes a bit more of an issue. But it's still an issue in our everyday lives. And if you're talking about everyday lives, then I suppose you want to include some of that sometimes. But I'm not going to write about toilets in every book.
that's book two, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
The Stranding's been out now for almost a year. It's now out in paperback. So I was wondering whether you could share with us things that you've learned along the way, things that you've learned about yourself, about the process itself. And if you could go back in time and speak to yourself just as your first publication day approached, what would you say?
I mean, enjoy it as much as possible and celebrate it for yourself. So celebrate your wins, every win, because sometimes it feels you have to be your own biggest champion, I suppose. And recognizing all of these little steps along the way is actually what makes the bigger picture. I suppose being released when I did, which was June 2021, when the hardback came out, it was difficult because there weren't the events. It was also like a sort of weird time where everything was supposed to be opening up, but then they changed their mind and it was still the rule of six. And so it was like, are we going to have a book launch? There might be a possibility for events. It didn't, but it was just a bit unsure. And I really threw myself at doing the online events that were available. And looking back, it was great. But at the time, it just felt a bit like I wasn't able to do the things that I'd hoped to do. But there were some real benefits to doing it from home with a small child, and I met some really great people that possibly I wouldn't have met if I hadn't done those things online. And the support of I set up a debut group on Twitter inspired by, in 2020, Polly Crosby set one up for the debuts that are coming out in 2020. And so I followed suit and did it in 2021. And then I know that you've got one for 2022. And I would recommend, even though hopefully everything will stay open, that debut authors that are coming out in 2023 do the same thing, because it connects you to people around the country whose books are coming out at different times that will receive different levels of success. And you'll see as well that success doesn't necessarily look like what you were expecting, that people find different readerships. And I know that I'm still really early in that journey. And it's sort of trying to remember that, I think, is that it's a really long road, or it is if it's something that you want to do ongoing. If you've discovered that you really love writing, it's going to be a long road of disappointments and wins. So celebrate every win and recognize that the disappointments happen to everybody, but just in different ways.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I think, like you said, the community is really helpful for debuts. I know the 2023 debuts have already started the group, so hopefully they'll have the same similar experience. Yeah. Obviously, publishing is complicated and quite a confusing industry to step into when you're a debut. Is there anything about it that you kind of know now that you didn't know then that would have been helpful for you to have known back then?
Being your own champion is really important. So both celebrating your wins, but also knowing that your publishers have got lots of books. Like, I always try and keep this in my mind that you're important to your editor, you're important to your publishing team, but they've got lots of books that are important to them and you only have your book. So try and remember that perspective. And then also try and make it about relationships, I think, is the nicest way to go about it. So it's about forming relationships with other authors, because you help to promote each other's work. It's about forming relationships with booksellers, because they essentially, they hand sell your work. So not only are, you know, you can make friends with these people, it will be a long-term relationship and it's really fulfilling. And of course, readers and bloggers, like bloggers and readers, are also there to make relationships with. And I think if you view it like that, rather than just about getting this product out there, it becomes much more fulfilling. But at the same time, you are getting your product, the book, and yourself, really, the brand of you a bit out there, and it becomes less corporate and more enjoyable, but it's still fulfilling the same purpose. Because we can't all be Richard Osmond. And he also, Richard Osmond also had a particular public profile that allowed his book to go there. We have to recognize that as well. So yeah, it's a tandem thing, but something that you can get involved with. And the more you do it, the more that you collaborate with your publishers on doing that, the more that they will sort of help you, I think. So help them to help you by daring to put yourself out there a bit, I think.
So let's talk about some of your highlights now, because I know you've had some amazing successes and we've obviously got to talk about the Costa nomination. So what have been your highlights since publication?
I've really enjoyed doing events. I was lucky enough to have a few small events, even though it was like a weird time, particularly meeting Katie at Storytellers Inc. I went up and did the book club there, and that was really fun. First of all, it was the first time I'd traveled across the country for so long, but also just to meet Katie, because she'd been so supportive of the debuts and is just in general of authors on Twitter, and so to meet her in person was really lovely. And then book clubs of friends as well, that has been really lovely. I did a lovely event at Toppings in Ely. That was my first event, so probably that's why it sticks so much in my head. And then, you know what? It's been talking to other authors. So, because it feels like finding a community, and particularly since doing the podcast and doing podcasts like this one, it's remembering that we're all going through similar stuff, because sometimes it can feel very isolating. And so there's that. But then the other part of it is I love editing. When I was acting, I always loved rehearsal more than performance. And editing has that similar vibe where you're sort of trying things out and moving things around, and then something clicks and you make a connection and it's like, oh yes, this is the good stuff. That's a high that is hard to find elsewhere. Yeah, so that, I think editing, events and authors would be my, and also reading authors' work, becoming more aware of books that I wouldn't have been previously, because the way that books are presented, you know, you have got those booksellers that do, that's why I think people should talk to booksellers in all bookshops, because that's how you find unusual stuff. Tell them what you like and see what they give you that's like it. But if you are someone that goes into a bookshop and chooses one off the table, then you, which I had done quite a lot of in London, perhaps because I was busy or whatever. And yeah, so this has been a really great way to discover books outside of what I think I might like.
So then tell us about your podcast, Novel Experience, and you've just recently launched that. So how did you come up with the idea, and what have you learned from speaking to other writers?
So my publicist, when we met for lunch, like back in, I think it was November last year, she said, I think you should do a podcast. And I was like, oh no, that sounds like a lot of work. and then you did yours. So what was it, in January? I think you launched it.
Yeah, started in January. Yeah.
And I said to you, well, I've had this on my list for quite some time, and really well done you for getting yourself together. And then it was really strange. I finished the edit of my second book, the first structural edit. And I was like, okay, now's the moment to do it. Like, I have an idea. I just thought it was about, rather than it just, yeah, it was about the experience of being a novelist, I guess, which is a similar thing to what you're doing. It's exploring how people write and why they write what they write. And I realized that I didn't have to be, you know, Elizabeth Day has that brilliant structure of How to Fail and the three questions that she asks. And I was sort of trying to find that before I launched it. But then I realized that actually, like Adam Buxton's podcast and your podcast, the ones that I really quite enjoy, and even like what page podcast, where people are talking just like a conversation and it goes all over the place. I really enjoy listening to those ones. So yeah, that's what I do. I talk to authors with an opening question about if they've always written, and then go from there and see where we go. So it is can be a bit rambling, I guess, but in the nicest possible way, full of covering different subject matters.
And you just mentioned there about writing your latest book. How has the fact that you've already got a book out there changed your writing process and your writing routine? Because obviously now you're writing to a deadline, so I'm guessing that changes things and makes it a bit more pressured.
Yeah, as you know, because you'll be doing that at the moment, writing your second book, it's really hard to, even when your book hasn't come out, to start writing it, which was the aim, was to try and have a first draft by the time the hardback was published. I didn't quite manage it. I'd like overshot by a couple of months. But the end came quite quickly. It was really hard to think of the fact that it would be read by people. really hard to turn off that, like, watching myself and thinking, judging it at every corner. And I found eventually, after a lot of trying, that it is about the characters for me. So I have to sort of write around the characters, I think, for a while. And then I can, once I know who they are, I can charge forward with a story. But yeah, that was what I found with this one. So, but I like writing characters anyway. That's my main interest, is character-based stuff.
So obviously you've got a lot of connections now with other writers, and you've been writing now with yourself for a long time. So can you share with us your top three tips for writers that are embarking on their first novel, or maybe written for a long time? What would be your top bit of advice, top three bits of advice?
Well, a lot of this comes from talking to people on Novel Experience. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that there is no formula. So everybody does it differently, and that the main barriers are psychological ones. Certainly for getting a draft out. So employ whatever tricks you can. So some people write on their phones, some people write on notepads. So it's trying out what works for you, and then sticking to that, I think, because it's not, you can't edit something that doesn't exist. So whether it's having a time limit that suits you, or whether it's having a word count that suits you, or whether it's writing every weekend or writing every morning, you can't tell someone the best way to do it, but you can say, find one of those things or try one of those things and see what works. I mean, I'm still sort of the let's try Pomodoro technique this week, or let's try writing in the morning this week, or let's try writing at night this week. And I think that's okay too, but it's making sure you're doing the writing. And sometimes, yeah, those, that, so that, that would be one thing, is to think that there aren't hard and fast rules about how you write, how one writes. So experiment, maybe, and find what works for you. I think one of the things that's been really good for me is starting gardening. I think having a hobby or something that you can get slightly obsessed with that takes up quite a bit of your time is really helpful. and not Twitter. So Twitter can be something you can get obsessed with and take up a lot of your time. But what I'm talking about is a project that is different from writing, for two reasons. One, it can stimulate your creativity. You know, best ideas often come when washing up, or, you know, traveling. For lots of people say this, when they're doing something that their brain is engaged but not on the activity of writing. So it provides that time for creativity, but also if it's something that slightly obsesses you, it might draw your obsession away from the pursuit of your book getting out there, I suppose. Because it does feel a bit all-consuming. It's understandable, there's a lot of emotions tied up with your first book going out into the world, but you've got to try and find some way to negate that a bit. You need to offset it a bit with another obsession, would be my, I mean, maybe you're someone that's really chill and you don't need it. Meditation would probably be a good one too, but I found knitting, so I wouldn't look at my phone, really helpful.
Good idea.
So those were two things. But I think if you would like to go through a cookbook, you know, anything like that would work.
And one more bit of advice?
Oh yeah, one more bit. Oh, well, read lots. I mean, that's not a new thing, but my editor actually says that when I'm writing, I should read outside of the genre of what I'm writing. So my second book is a not entirely, not chronological family saga. So it's a family, it's about a story about a family. Saga might be the wrong word, but essentially it is, because it covers a long period of time. So essentially I banned myself, or I did ban myself from reading those while I was editing. And it just meant that the reading is still informative, but not
doesn't by... clash, yeah.
Yeah, and it's and that is a really helpful thing to do. Yeah, and then you can really enjoy a family saga when you start writing your family saga, or your thriller when you start writing your thriller, yeah.
Going back now to The Stranding, and we've talked about how unique this book is, but I was wondering if you can think of any comparisons, books that you think maybe share similar space or similar themes, things that you think readers, if they enjoy those books, they would enjoy The Stranding as well.
I think this is a bit of an odd comparison. I don't know if I've made it before, but I think in the sort of episodic long period of time quality, you could say there might be some similarities to One Day, which it isn't, you know, the same formula, but like One Day or The Time Traveler's Wife, that have at the core sort of a romance that's trying to work its way out through episodic elements, and it not being completely chronological. Both strands of The Stranding are chronological, but what I mean is it's not a straight timeline. Well, there's quite a few books about women surviving the end of the world that came out recently that have similarities. But I suppose another influence on me that isn't about the same thing, but Station 11, which, you know, won, it's such a masterpiece, I think. And so, you know, holds it saying, oh, it's quite similar to my book. It feels a bit much. But having watched it, because I'm currently working with Athol Hirsch on the screenplay adaptation, it's really early stages. Who knows if it will ever be seen on screen. But we both watched the new series of Station 11 for like a comparison, really, of how a book can translate to TV. And I was reminded of certain things that have similarities in it. It's a long time since I read Station 11. But there is that thing about what remains in humanity, or what are the like resilient, what resilience is in humans. So, and also reflection on how good the world is currently. Is it this, is it a utopia, or is it maybe not?
Although you're nervous about comparing it, I do think it's a good comparison.
Oh, that's very kind, Chloe, thank you.
And you've touched on it briefly already, but are you able to tell us a little bit about the plot of your new novel that will be out next year?
I don't know if I can like surmise a plot, but I can say that this family will be out in June 2023. It is about a family that isn't necessarily a nuclear family, that is it takes place over the course of 24 hours in a garden in Suffolk, which is where I'm from and where I now live again, but also is across 40 years in London, Suffolk, New York, LA, all of which are places that I've lived. So so it has multi perspectives and multi locations and multi times, but tells, I hope, a character portrait of these nine people in a family.
Sounds great, and I love a family saga, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Yay.
Thank you so much, Kate, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you, Chloe. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
That was Kate Sawyer talking about her post-apocalyptic debut, The Stranding, which is out now in paperback. Before I go, let me just tell you about two events I've got coming up where I'm hosting this podcast, Confessions of a Debut Novelist, live. First, I'm going to be talking to three authors at the Being a Writer Festival, hosted by the Literary Consultancy on June the 28th. Then on July the 22nd, I'm going to be talking to Louise Morrish about her historical novel at Jericho Writers' Summer Festival. Both of these events are virtual, so you can join anywhere in the world and even ask questions. And if you're interested in hearing me talk in person about my novel, The Sea Women, I'll be at the Margate Bookie on Thursday the 2nd of June. Tickets for all these events are available to buy, and I'll put all the details in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.